this disaster-stricken city are starting to assess and comprehend the extent of the damage of a blast that was far more destructive than any explosion Lebanon has ever seen. Just before sunset on Tuesday, highly explosive material stored at a warehouse at Beirut port caused the blast, sending shockwaves across a city now in ruins. Almost every building has been damaged. Many are dead. Thousands are injured, and hundreds are missing. Rescue workers work through the night and into the morning as people and bodies were feared trapped underneath the rubble.
My husband is an employee at the electricity company. He survived, but his colleagues didn't. They're only now removing their bodies from under the rubble.
This is a country already reeling from a dire economic crisis, where 50% of the population live below the poverty line. Its people are not in a position to cope with this disaster.
Material losses are sad, but it's nothing compared to those who lost their lives. This is my taxi, it's my livelihood, and I'm still paying for it.
Everyone has a story of survival or tragedy. The damage spread several kilometers. Many are blaming those in power for the catastrophe.
This was Lebanon's Hiroshima. We trusted them with our money, our souls, our lives, and they betrayed us. Why are they still in power? They should all resign. We only have God now. Their day will come.
So that was from an Al Jazeera report on the explosion, massive explosion in Beirut, Lebanon. Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. So Beirut's blown up with 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate that had been sitting in bags labeled Nitropril HD in a warehouse for almost 7 years after being taken off a crippled vessel flying the Moldovan flag. The blast has killed more than 100 people, injured thousands, and left 300,000 homeless. So what really happened? Lebanon's LBCI-TV reported that the fire was accidentally started by welders closing off a gap that allowed unauthorized entry into a warehouse identified as Warehouse 9. Apparently, sparks from their torches ignited fireworks stored there, starting a fire that spread to Warehouse 12, where the ammonium nitrate was. Meanwhile, though, President Trump is saying that his generals told him it was an attack. We have a report from Pepe Escobar, who says a weapons expert told him that it was a small tactical nuclear weapon. We've got CIA, former CIA operator Bob Baer saying, oh, this was a military ordnance explosion. So everybody is going off in all different directions. As we all, you know, sit here in our COVID bubble thousands of miles away. So why should we care about what happened? Well, because there's an explosion of that magnitude in the Middle East can do all kinds of things, including even triggering war, and even possibly a war that would require more of our blood and treasure, one that if past is prologue, we the people in our currently depleted economic state wouldn't have much of a say about if that decision were made. So today I've brought back investigative reporter, attorney, and author Charlotte Dennett, who was born in Beirut. She was the daughter, or is the daughter, of America's first master spy in the Middle East, worked as a reporter in Lebanon, and has spent decades exposing the major players and their agendas over there, including those of our own government. She's going to give us the much-needed context for explaining why this explosion, accidental or not, has raised the entire world's blood pressure. Welcome, Charlotte.
Hey, great to be with you again, Christina.
So, Char, the first thing I want you to do is talk about what you, as an investigative reporter, do the minute you are aware of an event like this.
Yeah, I have my rule of thumb, which is when a huge crisis happens, watch the media for the next 48 hours very intently, because when you do that, there are witness reports that come in, and the news people, you know, they're so anxious to get a story out that they will reproduce what witnesses say. And then all too often, not that witness reports are always reliable, of course they're not, but if you find enough that have a sort of consistency from one witness to the next, you should take it seriously, because after about 48 hours, then the official cover-up starts to come in. It's almost inevitable, and it happens an awful lot when it has to do with the Middle East, which is a highly censored part of the world in any circumstances.
So what have you noticed?
What have I noticed? I was looking at the first reports, and a couple of things caught me. I mean, obviously, even now, there's an effort to say that it was an accident. So I'm looking at all the news reports, and I find that there was initial fire that triggered the larger explosion. So that raises the question, how did the fire start? Now, you just offered a scenario about welders, which could have been welding near the area, and that's the spark that set it off, which is feasible.
Spark from a weld?
Well, the sparks will fly when you weld, right?
Here's the thing. The spark from the weld, sparks from the weld cause a fire in a fireworks factory that then jumps over to the ammonium nitrate warehouse.
Yeah, well, that's an effort.
Fireworks in a warehouse where fireworks are being stored. I'm sorry, the fireworks are being stored. Sparks hit that, fire goes up, and then it jumps over. Don't you think people would have noticed the fire in the first warehouse?
People did notice the fire, but then you've got to add some other factors in here. For instance, several sources have indicated that Israeli planes were flying above the city at the very time that this happened. Now, then the answer to that is, well, that's been happening a lot anyway, so you can't necessarily draw any conclusions from that. But I was listening to a woman who was talking to Al Jazeera, and what she describes is that she was sitting watching Netflix with her husband in their living room, and she heard planes overhead, and so she went out to her balcony to see the planes, and that's when the explosion happened. And she was saying that a lot of people have been disturbed about these plane flights, and she leaves the impression that there is a widespread speculation that Israel is behind this. Again, you know, all we can do is pick up little pieces of facts here and there.
Let me just jump in here for a second.
Sure.
And I'm going to ask Jess to play the second clip, because that's Zina Kadar, who's an Al Jazeera correspondent living in Beirut, who talks about, at first she thought it was the Israelis. You know, I think it's important to listen to that.
I was a few kilometers. Shockwaves were felt across the city. I was a few kilometers from here walking in the street when I heard a thud. I thought it was a mock air raid, because Israeli warplanes have been flying frequently, violating Lebanese airspace as of late. But then I saw smoke, and the shockwave pushed us to the ground. Glass everywhere, panic, chaos. This country hasn't been immune, really, to political violence and to assassination. So the first thing that came to our minds, that this is yet another political assassination. And then reports emerged that some sort of an accident happened at a Beirut port. But people here are refusing to call it an accident. They're calling it a man-made disaster. They're blaming the authorities for this. Hundreds of people remain missing, many of them port employees, people who were working at Beirut port when that explosion went off. Their families are hoping that they will be found alive, but As you can see, it's going to be very, very difficult even to find the remains of people. There was a fire. It began with a fire at one of the warehouses, and firefighters were called in. And as they were trying to put out the flames, the fire spread to the warehouse where that ammonium nitrate was stored, and that caused the blast. So horrific scenes. Mm. We've been driving across the city this morning. Almost every building is damaged, and 300,000 people are now made homeless.
So what do you think of that report, Charlotte?
Well, let's deal with the planes. I mean, she talks about that, then she talks about the fire starting and sort of leaves that theory behind. But here's an example where I've heard it now from three different sources that there are Israeli planes flying above. And in one of them, and it is an Al Jazeera source, in the past couple of days, the woman says that people were expecting something. She ran out on the balcony to watch these planes yet again, and then got hit with the blast, and then says that she wouldn't name the Israelis. She just said that there are planes above, but people have been expecting something. So you know what she's thinking as well. Now, other news reports are saying that the Lebanese tend to blame Israel. There's another characterization, which is, Beirut is the capital of conspiracy theories. And another one says Lebanon, being Lebanon, suspects it wasn't an accident. Now, what I have to say, having lived there, you got to live there to understand why people are intensely political. I mean, Lebanon has come under attack for centuries, and more recently, I mean, it was under the Ottoman Empire, then it was under the French, then it gets attacked and invaded by Israel. And one thing that often gets overlooked is Lebanon's location. And so when I look at an event in the Middle East, I take into consideration geopolitical factors. What's its location? What's going on politically behind the scenes at the time that the crisis breaks out? And I usually do a rule of thumb timeline, which is always very helpful. And, you know, what pops up? My goodness. Let me just throw out some things that I've learned. Apparently, according to the Jewish press, and it's only reported there, if you want to know what's going on over there, they should look at Haaretz or the more conservative Jerusalem Post. But I get a lot of my information from there. They seem to that they're far better informed than the American public, for instance. And they're probably better informed because they live it. Anyway, first of all, apparently the group that had security over the port was Hezbollah, that paramilitary organization that grew in power dramatically after the Israelis invaded Lebanon in, I think, 2006. I'd have to go back and look, but at any rate, and they actually they fought the Israelis, so they got a lot of popular support in the southern part of Lebanon, which borders Israel. Then what they ended up doing is creating, like, social networks. You know, they provided food. They helped people that had been affected by the invasion. And then finally what they ended up doing is running for political office. So they are now in parliament. And the head of Lebanon, the president, Michel Aoun, is allied with Hezbollah. So then let's come back to the fact that according to the Israeli press, Hezbollah had control over the security of the port and that it used some of that ammonium nitrate for weapons. Okay, so we got that. Now, if you want to be just stuck in the back and forth, like who was directly responsible. You can keep it to that level. That's certainly the safest level when you're trying to analyze what happened. I tend to broaden it out. And the other factors that play into this, and timing is crucial, is the fact that a special tribunal on Lebanon that was set up after the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, way back in 2005, okay? There have been all sorts of efforts to investigate, and it finally did happen, and the tribunal was formed.
yeah, and Hariri his death, his assassination is the equivalent of the JFK assassination here for
yeah,
the Lebanese.
That
people need to
I
understand
see.
How important that is. You, that's how you described it to me over the phone yesterday, right?
Yeah, it's in my book, and which, by the way, has a whole chapter on Lebanon. The crash of Flight 3804, Lost Spy, Daughter's Quest, and the deadly politics of the Great Game for Oil. So the assassination of Hariri is the equivalent. It still has not been solved. But today, the tribunal was supposed to announce its verdict. It had tried in absentia, mind you, some leaders of Hezbollah. When I was there in 2011, that was the last time I was in Lebanon, and the Hariri assassination, which also was a huge explosion, sent people in his motorcade sky high, even back then. All sorts of speculation. Was it the Syrians that did it? Was, and in fact, an initial investigation blamed the Syrians. Then that was discredited.
Why would the Syrians want him dead?
Why did Syrians? Well, that's a big question. I mean, Hariri was trying to negotiate some kind of deal with the Syrians that... The Syrians, after the civil war, the Syrians came into Lebanon and occupied it, and that created a lot of anger. One of the end results of the Hariri assassination is that there was enough public outcry that the Syrians withdrew. So one could argue that the purpose of the assassination was to get the Syrians out of Lebanon. You have to factor in all these things. Now, one of the things that I show in my book is the theory that he was assassinated because he objected to a U.S./NATO military base being established in Lebanon. And this is quite well documented. Then I tried to follow up to see if there actually such a base had been built. And it had not been built, but according to a reporter who visited northern Lebanon, I think he was a Christian Science Monitor reporter, I'm not sure. But at any rate, he reported seeing an air base, a small base that already existed being built up. And it was on the border of Syria. And, of course, this was at the very time that the Syrian civil war started taking off, which was 2011. So coming back to, all right, timing, let's do timing, and then remind me to get back to location. So okay. Timing. They're about to release this verdict. That in and of itself would have been a huge issue, because either they're going to find Hezbollah guilty, and Hezbollah has persistently denied it, or the tribunals is going to say we didn't have enough evidence to convict, and that's going to get a lot of people very upset as well. So it's already fraught with tension, along with Lebanon's economic woes. So guess what? It was postponed. And I was just listening to a podcast from a Lebanese man, it's called Beirut Banyan. Banyan means is a special tree that grows at the American University of Beirut. But at any event, he was talking to a woman who has been involved with the tribunal, and she wasn't about to say how the verdict was going to be. But one of the things he said is that the Lebanese are so tired of not having accountability. Things keep getting put off. He lost his father through an assassination in 2013. And so he's been following all the tribunal, all the failed efforts to finally find the culprit. And he keeps asking her, you know, why is it taking so long? How can you have any faith in the tribunal? And she says, well, at least people are going to be able to see the evidence. And so in that respect, its findings will be transparent. But at any event, what's missing now, even if this is postponed for 2 months, I mean, if it's postponed for 2 weeks, sorry, it's just kicking the can down the road because Lebanon is going to blow up even more politically in the next 2 weeks. There's supposed to be huge protests tomorrow. And part of the situation is that the Lebanese people are totally fed up with the government. And it seems that it's a plague on all the parties. The Lebanese are so tired of having violence and assassinations and no accountability, and the government is indeed very corrupt. So we got that factor going on. The country is in complete shambles now. Now let's move on to other geopolitical factors. If you want to understand Lebanon, you got to pull out a map that shows the Middle East, and of course, Lebanon is there. Now, what's Lebanon's location? It's directly north of Israel, and it's directly south of Syria. And so what I point out in my book is that it is also, it was when I was there as a reporter, and that was way back in the 70s, but when I was there, people used to call Lebanon the gateway to the Middle East. But I eventually came to learn that oil men look at it differently. It's the gateway to Middle East oil. And what I ended up finding out is that at least three major pipelines, two carrying the oil of Iraq, which was the prize of World War One, by the way, one branch ended up in Haifa, Palestine, the other one was in northern Lebanon. And the third pipeline, the Trans-Arabian pipeline, was carrying Saudi oil to Lebanon. So it is a highly national security part of the world, which is why...
Well, what's interesting, too, about this explosion, and I don't know if this is something to factor in, weighing on the side that it was accidental versus, intentional, is the fact that that port, I mean, 82% of anything that comes into Lebanon comes in through that port. I mean, the destruction of that port is an exponential financial disaster for the Lebanese right
now. It's total. So you have to think like most investigative journalists should be thinking, who, if anyone, benefits? Obviously, the Lebanese people don't benefit from this explosion. Right. It's been a disaster. I mean, so I have to put into my analysis cap several different scenarios. And
I mean, it's a little weird that airplanes were flying overhead, Israeli planes were flying overhead right before it happened or whatever. And also, I was interested when she said that she heard a thud.
Uh-huh. Well, who knows? Maybe something was dropped. We don't know. And by the way, we may never know.
Right,
Lebanese people.
That's the thing that's so horrible.
Yeah. So I believe there was an allegation that there was an Israeli plane over the place where Hariri was assassinated. Anyway, you know, when Trump talks about how he talked to, quote-unquote, my generals, and they told me that it was an attack and probably a bomb. Well, I haven't seen one report, not one, to analyze what he just said. Who are Trump's generals? We know that Defense Department people have come out and denied it. One of the things that I found very interesting is that on the same evening as the explosion was being reported, Rachel Maddow headlined her her story, "This is what you don't do." It was a message to Trump. You don't throw out a theory and before it can be explained. Now, what she was doing is she was totally ridiculing any thought that this could have been a bomb or an attack, but she even said something that could lead to war. I'm pretty sure I heard her say that. So what I suspect is that Trump was being his usual inartful, ignorant self and put that out there, and that the saner heads that have prevailed up until now in the military and in the intelligence communities know that if you say that that's an attack, that's just going to heighten all the tensions in the Middle East even more, because we're not only just talking about Lebanon, we're talking about Hezbollah. Hezbollah is backed by Iran. Trump has been trying to weaken it. If he can't send troops to Iran, because I think saner heads have prevailed, he will do anything to, quote-unquote, apply maximum pressure. And again, looking at the timeline, it turns out that the Israelis made some attacks right on Iranian territory. One of them was in a nuclear facility. And the only reason that didn't trigger a war is because the Iranians are trying to hold out until the elections, and they've decided not to be provoked. And, of course, you know about all those tankers that were hit either in the Gulf area, it's called the Gulf interchangeably, Persian Arab Gulf, but the Gulf, and a lot of oil traffic goes through a very narrow Strait of Hormuz to get out of the Gulf and into, you know, tankers carrying oil to foreign markets. And on the other side of Arabia is the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, another tiny chokehold where tanker traffic passes through. And so my guess is that there's a great deal of nervousness going on right now between the military. And Trump is still trying to stick to his guns. Now,
Have you heard of this report from this blogger named Richard Silverstein? He wrote an article for Tikkun Olam.
Tikkun, yeah.
And he basically said that, and of course this is uncorroborated, so I'm not saying, you know, this is true because I haven't been able to check it out. We're just talking about what different people are saying. He wrote that a confidential, highly informed Israeli source has told him that Israel caused the massive explosion at the Beirut port earlier today. And what they were doing, apparently, was they obviously didn't mean to blow up, you know, half of Beirut, but they did mean to blow up a Hezbollah, a warehouse where apparently Hezbollah had bombs, yes, but munitions stored, mm-hmm, had weapons, a weapons depot.
Yeah, well, and interesting that you found that source. I mean, Tikkun, that's a magazine of Jewish intellectuals who tend to be on the liberal side. So I haven't seen that. Please send me the link. But look, when you look at it from a geopolitical standpoint, it sort of makes sense that Israel would be behind it. By the way, government officials have ignored it, but I think it was in the New York Times where I read that the military was silent on the issue. Then we look at another factor in the timing. You know, Trump and Kushner have their big plans for the region, peace plan, and they probably have figured out by now that Trump's going to lose the election unless he does, you know, does something really extreme like declare martial law or postpone the elections because of COVID. But Trump's time is up, and so is Netanyahu's, is literally being tried right now for corruption. So I'm thinking that the hawks that have always wanted to create a new Middle East, and this goes back to the pre-Bush years, figure that this is the time to strike because both the U.S. is very weak and Lebanon is just flattened. And then there's the other factor that comes in here, that there are huge oil and gas deposits off the coast of what's called the Levant, which includes Lebanon and Syria and Israel. Levant meaning stemming from the French word of the sun rising in the east. And so that, which I delved into in my book, because that, who owns those oil and gas deposits offshore? needs it for their energy needs. The Israelis have consistently fought against the Gazans because the Gaza Strip borders part of those giant fields.
Well, I mean, it seems like Gaza now is, it's almost the whole, Trump, it's very interesting. Trump has basically made, they're calling it the deal of the century. For Israel, I mean, first of all, making Jerusalem the capital, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital, mm-hmm. and, you know, not saying anything about the expanding, ever expanding. I mean, what is left of Gaza, basically?
I mean, you know, Gaza, there was an all-out attempt to destroy Gaza, and I have quotes from Israeli military officials saying that we're going to send them back to the Stone Age, okay? And it is an open-air prison, as people are calling it. I mean, the situation is dire in Gaza. Now it's dire in Lebanon. Let's come back and look at the map. The dream of Israel and its allies is to turn that whole section of eastern Mediterranean they border on into an energy corridor. So, you know, Israel has staked its claim to the largest bulk of those oil and gas fields, and it has always wanted to run a pipeline to Europe. But to do that, it would have to go through Lebanon and Syria. Well, the original plan, right around the time of the launching of the war in Iraq, was that Israel wanted to reopen the Iraq Petroleum Company pipeline that had run from Iraq to Haifa, Israel. They wanted to reopen it. And Netanyahu boasted about it. He got in a lot of trouble. He was finance minister. This is back in 2003. But he boasted that the oil of Iraq would soon be flowing to Israel, and that this was not a pipe dream. And as we see, it has been a pipe dream because of all the conflict in the area. And you got the big powers using their proxies. You know, the Russians are there supporting Syria. And two big plans so far have failed. One of them was reopening the pipeline, which had been closed in 1948 during Israel's war for independence, and the Iraqis shut off the oil in protest. So the plan was to overthrow the government of Iraq through the invasion and Saddam Hussein, put in place a pro-Israel leader, and they had considered that was going to be Ahmad Shalabi, who was an Iraqi living in exile. So the big power plan was put him in and then get the pipeline restored, because he favored doing that. And the only reason that didn't happen is because it was exposed that he was the creator of the rumor of weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
And so that was blown,
he created that propaganda line. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't use him to prop up Iraq. And they haven't had stability in Iraq ever since the invasion. So that plan was foiled. Then there's the whole thing about going after Israel.
But it's not entirely Syria, rather. That plan may be foiled, like, in the short term, but I think in the long term, the Project for a New American Century, Rebuilding America's Defenses document that talks about, you know, basically neutralizing all of these, you know, in succession, all of these Middle Eastern states. I mean, Iraq is a mess now. Lebanon is a mess. Syria. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like you feel this consolidation plan. It's messy and it's years, but that's what's going on here. And Lebanon has just, I think, had the final nail put in. That's what I'm thinking or seeing. Am I wrong in my assessment? Is there something I'm missing?
Well, I mean, certainly hold that as a working hypothesis. I mean, what do we know? All we can do is try to pull out as much as we can from the reports and to talk to people. I know some people over there. And here's the thing. There's going to be a huge demonstration tomorrow in Lebanon, Saturday. And the people, the populace, are claiming there has to be a revolution. And one person was quoted as saying, they're going to kill us, or then we're going to kill them back. Now you got a situation where I think the people are beyond being afraid. And when for their lives in protesting. And when that happens, you know, the powers that be better worry. But on the other hand, my concern is they may be so deeply involved, trying to cut this off. There we go. That they're not seeing the bigger picture. I mean, and it's understanding these people have lived under constant violence for so long. What are they going up against? My God. I mean, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I would think that the powers that be see these massive demonstrations as opportunities to create more chaos. Well, I mean, that's what happened with the Arab Spring in Egypt. I mean, this is what keeps happening. You know,
yes,
people go out in the streets. I mean, it's their last cri du cœur, as they say in French, cry from the heart. And you've got, instigators and agents provocateur, provocateurs out there working to slice and dice everybody and cause some death so that everybody just like goes home and goes, okay, we're beaten.
Yeah, well, that certainly is not the feeling now among the people in Lebanon. When you read all the reports, you can see that their anger is overflowing. But, yeah, so the demonstrations are genuine. The anger against massive corruption inside the government is genuine and deserved. There is terrible corruption. It's just gotten worse and worse since the Civil War. So you got different members of parliament with different party affiliations will sort of skim off the top whatever aid has come into Lebanon, and the people are saying they don't care about us. So,
That's classic third world stuff. You know, I'm from Haiti. Haiti is a lost cause because everybody who gets involved in the political institutions, in the government agencies, and so on, to a man and woman, there everybody is on the take. So there's no government representing the people. The people themselves, you can't have millions of people governing themselves, and so you end up with a failed state. The failed state is the perfect playground, okay, for anybody looking to control resources and real estate.
Yes, precisely.
So, I mean,
and let me just say, one of my great concerns is for all these people that are going to go out and protest. I mean, I have no idea how well organized they are. It seems that today the protests in today's world are all spontaneous, and so you can't attribute them to any one leader. That's sort of a phenomenon ever since Occupy Wall Street, for instance. But the downside is that if you really want a revolution, you better know what you're going up against, you know. And I have no idea if there is that serious a resolve. I do know that people are just fed up. They want the whole government to collapse and to put something new in. And boy, that's admirable, but it hasn't succeeded.
But where do these leaders come from, and what's going to differentiate them from the crap they've had to deal with before? I mean, I see this. It's just, and the other thing is too, is, you know, when these things happen and leaders emerge, oftentimes those leaders have been created or, you know, manufactured and presented, you know, as the saviors of the people when they're actually, you know, working for some other country, you know? I mean, you see that over and over and over. In Haiti, when the elections happen, you know, you can't be, I don't care how bad a dictator you are, you can't be in power if you're not going to kowtow to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Who's going to be, who is going to live long enough to be a leader of the Lebanese people? Okay?
Somebody who
actually represents his own people or her own people, who is going to allow that person to live among those big gorillas who are interested in all of Lebanon's resources?
Yeah, well, there's a yeah, that's exactly right. I lost my train of thought, so keep going. I believe that is the problem right there. I mean, look at the Arab Spring. You know, so much idealism. And where has it borne fruit? There's just been one repressive regime after another to come in on top of it and squelch democracy.
Yeah, it's a perfect way to remove you know, one government that, okay, everybody hates and so on and so forth, but to also bring in your, you know, your cutout, you know, as the savior. Bring in your cutout as the savior. The savior gets in, he or she does a few things that make people smile, and then it's back to business as usual. Actually, it's even worse now, because then that person is going to open up the country to the exploitation of these other nations, you know, without the people even knowing most of the time. And you know, if you look at this, and if you look at this greater Israel plan, okay, that Trump has just really given a really big, you know, has put some wind into the sails of that boat. I mean, look at the map for that. Have you seen the greater Israel map? That includes
Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq,
parts of Egypt, including Cairo.
Look, it goes back to the territorial ambitions of the early Zionists, who had seen Israel occupying a much larger swath of territory than what it does now. So that's been a dream that has never been fulfilled. But here's another element you got to look at.
Well, it's not that it has never been fulfilled. I think you're looking at it the wrong way. I think you're looking at it. It's working towards its fulfillment. It's trying to get itself fulfilled. This is a multi-generational view here, I think. You know,
no,
I
you
think if you're
that.
If you're any kind of leader, if you're any kind, you know, that's how you're going to view it.
Yeah, I'm just saying, Christina, that this Greater Israel Project's been on the books since the turn of the 20th century, okay? And it was not achieved, even though a whole century goes by and it still hasn't been achieved. It doesn't mean they're not trying again. And I think Trump and Kushner are trying to do that. They're working with the Israelis. They're working with the Saudis. They have this whole plan for developing the Red Sea and, you know, all sorts of nice hotel resorts along the Red Sea. They're also talking about annexing the West Bank. Everyone's, like, all nervous about that because it's a violation of international law. But the one thing people are not looking at is the fact that there's been oil discovered on the West Bank. And there is, while we're speaking, a group that is prospecting for oil on the West Bank.
What group is that?
Well, I will tell you in a minute. If I can just, no, this is not it. I think it's called the Medved Fields. And I'll come back to it because I got to pull it up.
American international group?
It is, I believe, it as usual, it is a sort of combined efforts. The same thing with the Golan Heights, by the way. I have to say that with regard to the Levant countries, Lebanon, Syria, then Israel, the major driving force is control of oil. I mean, it's the Middle East.
I get that, but still, you're talking about the plans that are now moving faster than they have before. Okay, I mean, are now looking, let me not say moving faster than ever, but looking more doable than ever before. If you look at this, and what's the name of this plan? It's called Oded Yinon or something. It's called Oded Yinon, the plan, Greater Israel plan.
Yeah.
Now, the Atlantic in 2008, this is what they described. They said, it says, aside from a divided Iraq, which the Biden plan calls for, the Yinon plan calls for a divided Lebanon, Egypt, and Syria, the partitioning of Iran, Turkey, Somalia, and Pakistan also fall into line with these views. The Yinon plan also calls for the dissolution in North Africa, and forecasts it as starting from Egypt and then spilling over into Sudan, Libya, and the rest of the region. The plan operates on two essential premises. To survive, Israel must become a regional power. Okay, so that's one premise. To survive, they have to become an imperial regional power. And two, they must effect the division of the whole area into small states by the dissolution of all existing Arab states.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. So this may be, you know, part of the implementation of the plan. And like I say, one always has to answer who benefits if one cares to go beyond that it was just an accident. And from my point of view, when you factor in the timing, the release of the report on Hariri's assassination, the efforts to weaken Hezbollah in Iran, the fact that there were attacks by Israelis in Iran in early July, and the fact that Trump and Netanyahu are greatly weakened but still in power, then, you know, you can't look at this without looking at this bigger factors, including that plan.
I do want to say that the Times of Israel did report. Israel, of course, has denied this, and that we have to say that you know, this has to be reported. They have denied this, and they've actually offered humanitarian aid to Lebanon. Okay.
Yes, and the Lebanese have declined it, which tells you something.
Well, I mean, Silverstein, he described that offer as an act of real chutzpah, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, he also, he said, Likud's MK Moshe Feiglin tweeted a quotation from the Bible about the disaster, saying, "There have never been such great days in Israel as the 15th of Av, which is the day of the bombing, and Yom Kippur."
Yeah, well,
that's kind of a crappy comment to make at a time like that. I mean, that's Jesus. I just can't we all be human beings for a minute?
Well,
you know,
come on, we're living in the age of Trump. I mean, the crass heartlessness of the people in power right now, it just blows my mind. And it's here and it's over there. It's both. And they are ruled by greed, the need for power, and money. That's the dominating force. And the suffering continues to get magnified in multiple ways. And this is like the last straw that's hit Lebanon. It's just so tragic. You know, the civil war lasted 15 years. When I was there in 2011 on a family visit, I was talking to some local Lebanese. One of them, a young professor, was saying, well, if we have civil war in Lebanon, you ain't seen nothing yet. She knew about the potential for a mage was happening to the north of Syria, but now you got this, and the whole weakening of the economy. I haven't gotten a whole handle on how that happened, but the banks aren't operating. The people have no money. I don't know how they're surviving. There's going to have to be huge international aid that pours in. But the homelessness problem, how many, 500,000 people homeless or something like that?
300,000, according to this report, you know.
Right. So, I don't know. It's very depressing, but the Lebanese are resilient people, you know. So, maybe something better will come out of this catastrophe. By the way, I just looked it up about the oil field in the West Bank. It's called the Meged Field, M-E-G-E-D, and it's a, I got this off of Baus Arnon, an Israeli geologist who is part of the Alberta, Texas team. Alberta, that's got to be Canada. The field has considerable potential if it can be developed. Now, on the other hand, let me throw back.
Alberta, Texas?
No, Alberta, Canada.
And Texas team. So you're talking about Texas oil people?
Yeah, it's probably Texas oil people.
Why,
and those are Trump
allies,
you know. Trump is ruled by the oil companies, and particularly the shale oil people in Texas, and who are all going bottom up now because of the COVID-19. You know, but he was recently at a rally at the Permian Basin. It's a big shale oil area in Texas. And, you know, he was charging $100,000 or more per plate to talk with him. He was down there to do a huge fundraising among the oil companies. And it's mostly the shale oil companies that made out well during the first couple of years of Trump's reign. And since then, they just due to poor management and sheer greed, a lot of them were doing very badly by the time that COVID hit, and now that's wiping a lot of them out. But you also, when you're looking at this part of the world, you got to make a distinction between the majors, the big, huge oil companies, and that's like Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, which are all outgrowths of the great Rockefeller Standard Oil money, and then there's BP, Shell. All right, so you've got the big majors, and then you've got the wannabes. And my analysis has been that when Bush got into power, he was a wannabe. And that's why they wanted the oil of Iraq so badly. Because usually when a country discovers oil and then it puts out bids, the ones that inevitably win the bids are the big ones because they've got the machinery and the know-how and the expertise to do it. And so the little guys get shunted off. So Trump was the Trump regime was a great opportunity for the smaller shale oil and oil companies to make a killing. And in the end, that's all backfiring, but he's still desperately going out there trying to shore them up. And that's one reason why there's so much effort to open up Texas early. You know, who's behind that?
Right.
And what we never look at is who is behind doing all the dirty work. I just watched iRobots, the movie on TV last night. And right. At one point, the question is asked, well, who's guiding the robots? And the guiders of other human beings are invisible.
We're getting close to the end of this broadcast. And I guess what I want to say is it's striking when something like this happens, how it becomes a huge incident, even though you don't even know. It could just be a terrible accident, which of course means the blame falls on the Lebanese government for allowing that ammonium nitrate to be stored in that warehouse for so long. But you know, there were other signs: Israeli planes flying over right before it happened. Other people, you know, CIA people. You know, Trump, I don't know if he's the best source in the world, but, you know, he's saying his generals said that it was an attack. So, but the most heartbreaking part about this is that in the end, it all comes back to immense suffering on the part of millions of people due to the machinations of, you know, powerful forces that just don't give a damn about their lives, that consider them cockroaches, you know. So I think that's the takeaway. I send much love and major healing vibes to the people of Lebanon. And here's hoping some way this world will move up to transform into some sort of higher level so that all this madness comes to an end. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Christina with the Whistleblower Newsroom. Thank you, Shar, for coming on and sharing your wisdom.